Welcome to Boston Confidential, Beantown's true crime podcast. Boston is a great city, but there's more to it than the Freedom Trail and Fenway Park. There's a startling underbelly to the city, and Boston Confidential will take you on a guided tour of the hub of the universe, Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Boston Confidential. My name's Barry McGuire, and I'm your host. I'm a 20-year private investigator on the streets of Boston, and I help run a company called Impact Due Diligence Investigations. If you need anything in terms of investigative services, feel free to contact me at Impact. If I can't help you personally, I'll certainly direct you to the right person or agency. All right, guys, let's get to it. We got a tremendous response from our last episode on the Kimberly Cates homicide out of Mount Vernon, New Hampshire in 2009, and today is the second portion of that episode, part two. So I wanted to give a shout out to my sainted son who helped me last week when I was in Florida, and he posted the pod. And I guess I should give him a co-producing credit on this episode. So Sean, you are now a co-producer of a podcast, and I believe that could go on your resume as it stands right now. But in terms of the response we got, guys, I knew it would be big because this case is just so earth-shattering, and it really was. There was no real earthly reason for these kids to do it, and it's just a horrible thing. And before we get into it, the state of New Hampshire does have a capital punishment death penalty, right? But it's very limited. They restrict capital punishment for those who kill law enforcement officers, murder while serving a prison sentence or a life sentence, I think they say, and murder during kidnapping or murder during rape. So it's very limited. These kids wouldn't have been eligible for the death penalty due to their ages, I believe. But man, I think the New Hampshire legislature has changed that to include death penalty for homicide conducted during a home invasion like this. And I believe that is the best way to go. And I think that should be a federal crime because it's just so invasive, right? It's a home invasion. These two, Kimberly Cates and her daughter, were just in bed. That's all they did. They did nothing to anybody. Their dad and husband, David, had to be out of town. And these people think they can come in and start swinging a machete around and start ceaselessly stabbing 11-year-old Jamie Cates. If you're not safe in bed as an 11-year-old girl with your mother, sleeping on a Saturday night and looking forward to a Sunday morning at home, what are we doing as a country here? Those people need to be taken from this earth for what they did. And there's five people involved here. I think I had alternately said there was four, but don't forget about Autumn Savoy, who helped afterwards. So I'm going to get into all that. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to my son, Sean, and there it is. And also, there was something I stated in the last episode. I don't know why they picked the Cates house. And a friend of the show, Shelley, emailed in and stated that they had originally targeted another house. And I had mentioned that the Cates home wasn't the original target. But the original target had these barking dogs, and they didn't want any part of that. And they just moved on to the Cates house. Imagine that. Talk about happenstance, luck, bad luck, good luck. I don't know what it is with these madmen, but holy cow, guys. All right, so I think we ended last week's episode with a brief description of these madmen. The two people I believe are most evil in all this, Stephen Spader and Christopher Gribble. And I think I delved into their pasts and all that. But there's two other people we need to get into, and then Autumn Savoy briefly. And I'm going to tell you right now, guys, you're going to be angry. Some of these guys are already out on parole. That's so hard for me to stomach. It just really is. And these kids testified against the main two, Stephen Spader and Christopher Gribble, but man, I don't know. I think at one point the plea deal for Marks, William Marks, age 19, at the time of the murder, was originally rejected by the judge because she simply thought it was too lenient in the defendant's favor. I'm glad that was New Hampshire, because I don't think that would have happened in Massachusetts, quite frankly. So I think in terms of the actual story here, I took you up until the end of this horrific homicide, but there's more to that day. Well, it's actually the same morning, so I'll take you through that. We'll go through more of the suspect's past and all that, and I'll introduce you to Mr. Quinn Glover, age 19 at the time, and Mr. William Marks, who were present in the home, knowing what was going to happen, because Stephen Spader, on the way to this score, I guess you could say, this horrific homicide, stated, "We're about to do the most evil thing this town has ever seen." So it was kind of difficult, guys, for Glover and Marks to pretend they didn't know a homicide was going to take place. But let's get back to the night of the homicide. Well, it's actually the early morning hours now. So it's still the early morning hours of October 4th, 2009. And Christopher Gribble, Stephen Spader, Quinn Glover, and William Marks had just finished butchering the Cates family. And at about 5:30 a.m., they arrive at a friend's house. At least it's Gribble and Spader go to the home of another friend, Autumn Savoy, who knew they were planning. This is what he says. Autumn Savoy said that he knew they were planning a burglary, but didn't know it was going to be a homicide. That is nonsense, but whatever. So they go there and they tell him exactly what they did. This is, I don't know, an hour later, 2 hours later, something like that. So they're at Autumn Savoy's house and they tell Autumn Savoy, and for the longest time, I thought Autumn Savoy was a woman and a girlfriend of one of these guys. It turns out it's just a guy. I don't know if that makes a difference. The name just threw me off, guys. But they go there, they tell this guy what they did, and they all get into Autumn Savoy's vehicle and they go destroy evidence. Bloody clothing, some of the jewelry. Man, they are celebrating, guys. They're telling Autumn Savoy exactly what they did. And Autumn Savoy is such a great friend to these guys. He's, you know, a member of the Disciples of Destruction, right? Or at least he wants to be. And he doesn't go to the police. He helps them get rid of the machete, bloody clothes that they had worn, and some of the trinkets that they had stolen from the Cates family house. And it's just so goddamn sick. I don't know if Quinn Glover and Marks were present. They probably went home. They kind of crapped out in all this. They stayed outside of the room. I think William Marks was the first to try to break in. I may get these two guys confused, Quinn Glover and Marks. One of them tried to break in first and ended up stuck in the basement, I think. And then they pushed in an area near the air conditioner, and Stephen Spader slipped into the house that way. So Quinn Glover and William Marks didn't participate in hacking these two with a machete and then Jamie with a knife. But they were there and watched it. They knew it was happening. And then they left, and these goofballs go to Autumn Savoy's house and destroy evidence. But that's not the end of it. So at 5:30 that evening, after Gribble and Spader go home and get some sleep, they go to another friend's house, Kyle Fenton. And again, they're bragging. They can't stop talking. They're just that stupid, right? They go to Fenton's house, tell them what they did, high-fiving all around. At this point, Christopher Gribble says he's upset. I think around this time they learned that Jamie had survived, and he was upset about that. And they were ribbing Gribble about letting her live. So not so shockingly, these fools talking about this homicide are overheard by Kyle Fenton's mother, who goes to the police. And that's about the end of the ballgame, guys. Under 24 hours, and they're going to be in handcuffs. Just so stupid. They didn't seem to really give a shit. They were talking about it like they had just watched the New England Patriots win the Super Bowl. But the case breaks down even more. believe it or not, William Marks and Quinn Glover go to school the next day and they can't stop talking about it. And they tell a friend about it. And now the friend's scared because they threatened to kill him if he told anybody. Naturally, the kid is afraid and he had no part of this, but he's kind of unnamed in these court documents. I don't know if his name was ever released, but at least at school, they went to high school in Sauhegan High in Amherst, New Hampshire. So they go to school, threaten that kid, and then that kid goes to a school resource officer. And by the end of the school day, Marks and Glover are being interviewed. And by 6 a.m. the next day, the New Hampshire Attorney General has announced 4 arrests in this homicide. Thank God these kids were so stupid and were caught so quickly, because they were planning to do this again. And let me tell you a little bit more about Glover and Marks in this. Their parts, I'm not going to say they're minor. I guess they're less than Steven Spader and Christopher Gribble. But is it much less? They knew it was going to happen. They did it. I just don't know. You'll have to decide for yourself. Was their punishment enough? But let's get to these goofballs. So William Marks, I think I told you he was 19 at the time of this homicide. These aren't babies, you know, they're into adulthood. I don't even know why William Marks at age 19 was still in high school. It's odd, but Marks entered the house first. Somehow he gets kind of locked in the basement. He'd later find his way out and up to the main floor where the homicides took place. And he heard Kimberly Kate say, "Is that you, Jamie?" because these goofballs were making noise. After Marks got into the basement, they cut the power and they found Jamie's iPod and was using that as a light to guide them through. So by the time Marks gets upstairs, the homicides were about to take place, and he hears Kimberly Cates ask, "Is that you, Jamie?" And then it all takes place. And Glover at that point is standing in the door watching all of this take place. So somehow, I believe Marks, he was kind of squeamish in all this, and that may have reduced his prison sentence. But man, if you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound on all of this. And just when you think that these kids can't get any more dumb, they just set you straight. During conversations after William Marks had been placed in custody, and I believe that was right after school that day, and he hadn't seen the light of day in quite a while since, he's having conversation on the jailhouse phone, guys, which everybody who's ever watched the first 48 or any other crime show, you know those are all recorded phone calls. He's speaking with his father, who also seems to be a bit of an S-bag, James Marks. And James Marks and him are going back and forth about trying to sell this story to the national media. And they're very in-depth about this. They want to make some money from this story. This is how stupid they are, on a recorded line. And they don't want to go to the local media because they don't think they'll pay enough. And James Marks is talking, "You've got to go to CNN or Fox News and they'll pay for it." And this is before they're even charged. They had just done this. And that's what James Marks is talking to his son about. He had just committed the worst homicide, one of the worst homicides in New Hampshire history. And you're trying to make a few bucks off it. Imagine that. I do think James Marks, who at the time was 47 years of age, was ultimately charged. He was charged with some type of conspiracy in that, and I don't know whatever came of that criminal case. I believe it was a misdemeanor, but they did use that against them. And at trial, Mark said, "No, I wasn't trying to sell the story. I was trying to sell it to the jury." It was just another hodgepodge of insanity with these people. There's so much here, guys. I've got to kind of streamline it. Steven Spader wrote letters to a cellmate, and the cellmate ends up testifying against them in prison. Like, you don't know that? Have you ever watched Dragnet? Have you ever watched any crime show that people in jail are shitbirds and they're trying to feather their own nest? And so that's what that guy did. He testified against him at trial. And Spader laid out in these foolish letters because they love talking about it. They love what they did. They're proud of it. So in these letters, it's just insane. It's basically a confession. And there's so much evidence. I'm not going to get into all the DNA evidence and all this. It's just so overwhelming. A trial was almost unnecessary. But I can't believe these kids didn't face the harshest penalty available, all of them. But they did need Glover and Marks to testify against Spader and Gribble. I get that. I'm not a kid. I'm not a Pollyanna. I know how the criminal justice system works. It was so important to have those two get life sentences or worse. They had to deal with these two other losers, Quinn Glover and William Marks. And so they made the deal. And man, it's got to sit pretty hard with you as a prosecutor. Maybe they only would have needed one of them, but you have to eliminate all chances of acquittal at that point. And I think that's what they did. So James Marks, William Marks's dad, testified at trial when he hadn't heard from his son by about 11 p.m. on the night of the 4th. He started texting him, but he doesn't hear back until just after 4:15 in the morning, just after these animals had savaged the Cates at their home in Mount Vernon. So William Marks comes home, and I'm assuming that James Marks would think, geez, you have to be out drinking all night, something like that. So it's after 4 a.m. He comes stumbling in and really no questions. I don't know what type of home life this kid had. The only real home lives in this case that I've read about are from Spader and Gribble. But I don't know if this was an intact family for William Marks. But the dad is obviously lacking in character, right? He's trying to sell his son's story of the most horrific homicide in state history, right? So he's lacking there. One of the only things that William Marks had going for him, he was one of the first to tell the police what happened. I think as soon as the handcuffs came out, this was a scrum to the attorney general's office, right? Who could rat first? And that was William Marks. He told the entire story and eventually agreed to a plea deal. He was sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison, and he wasn't even going to get that sentence. A judge in the case kind of sent it back to the prosecutors and said this just simply wasn't enough. And he was eventually indicted by a grand jury for first-degree homicide and all this other stuff. But the plea that he eventually took and was approved by the judge was 30 to 60 years in jail. He's still in jail today. And I told you previously in this podcast that some of these guys were out on parole. And that's true. But I did get a little confused. I guess in New Hampshire, you can be paroled on one charge and still serve time on the others. So that was a little confusing. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go. But just briefly, Autumn Savoy was paroled, fully paroled. He was eventually sentenced to 5 to 12 years in prison, and he was convicted of events that happened afterwards. They destroyed evidence. He provided an alibi for these kids, Gribble and Stephen Spader, saying that they were at his house. And he was ultimately fully paroled in 2015. Man, that just does not seem to be enough in this case. But he also testified against Gribble and Spader. And during his parole hearing, they were kind of commending him for being a model prisoner, basically. And when he was getting out of the joint, he was due to live back in New Hampshire with his parents and worked two food service jobs at the Mall of New Hampshire. So if you're at the Mall of New Hampshire, which is a massive, massive mall, and you want to go grab a snack, that may be being cooked by Autumn Savoy. So how do you like them apples? And one of the reasons that I got confused about the parole system up there was because in Quinn Glover's case, he was paroled on some of these charges, but is still in the joint. And I had to research it a little further, and I found out he won't be eligible to be fully released from the joint until 2029. And at least in Massachusetts, I don't know if it's the same in Massachusetts, typically you don't make parole on your first application. So he may have some more time to do, and he deserves it. They deserve every day of it. I can't believe these guys are going to be let out to the streets, and Autumn Savoy is out flipping burgers at the Mall of New Hampshire. But that's the American justice system, right? The only redeeming qualities I can say about Quinn Glover and William Marks is they do show remorse. I believe Quinn Glover says he wakes up every day absolutely regretful for what he did. William Marks makes the same type of nonsensical pleas, I guess. Maybe it's true. Maybe it isn't. They're convicts now. They know how to work the system. It's just hard to give a shit about them. You know what I mean? So ultimately, a trial, to actually have to go through trials on this is just a waste. There's so much evidence. That's why I haven't went over with it, guys. I'm sure there's DNA. I don't think they needed it. They had people pointing the finger. They have Steven Spader basically admitting it. Gribble didn't do much less. Christopher Gribble actually pled insanity to the homicide charge, and that's a separate trial in New Hampshire. And I'll put that in the show notes because it's pretty extensive. And the prosecuting attorney really did a hell of a job in that portion of the trial. Really good job. It showed how deliberate Christopher Gribble was in what he had planned. Also on the stand during the insanity plea was Christopher Gribble's mother. And after testifying, Gribble had been overheard saying that he'd like to kill her. He'd like to kill her on the stand as she was right now. And the prosecutor asked him about that. And he's all smiles. He'll tell you anything you want to know. And he's being truthful. He's a boastful little bastard, right? None of these guys could have went up against a grown man or even a kid their own age, somebody who could fight back. He was ultimately sentenced to life without parole. He was deemed fit to stand trial, and he's currently serving his time somewhere, and I don't know where. But I did remember that he had suffered quite a beating in jail, and that put a smile on my face. Steven Spader was ultimately convicted on all counts, first-degree homicide, burglary, all that. No sense in naming all the charges. He was sentenced to life without parole plus 76 years. And the judge said at the time of sentencing, "We simply have to keep society safe from you for the rest of your life," or at least words to that effect. They just don't care. He's let out in handcuffs and just does not give a crap. So they did have some resentencing type arguments. And Steven Spader, I guess to his credit on some level, said he didn't want a sentence reduction. He didn't want to be on the streets because he said, and I quote, "the most sick man in the history," or whatever. It's kind of a humble brag. "I'm a sick bastard. Don't let me out of prison." So he did not go forward with a sentencing reduction attempt. Christopher Gribble did go through with the sentencing reduction bullshit, but he was also denied, and that's about it. Those two should be in the electric chair. That's my opinion. Some other background information on these losers. The Insane Clown Posse has these followers called Juggalos. If you don't remember the Insane Clown Posse, I don't blame you. They were this rap group of white disaffected youth who claimed to be super tough. And I know I had mentioned previously that I had grown up with some tough kids in South Boston. They got into boxing and kickboxing, and not one of them became a bully over it. But I don't think this Insane Clown Posse and Steven Spader, Christopher Gribble, Autumn Savoy, Quinn Glover, and William Marks could ever go up with anybody who could put their dukes up. And I think their time in prison shows that. I had read that Christopher Gribble had also gotten his ass kicked in prison. I hope that happens to him every day. I don't think he's as tough as he thinks he is. I think I also neglected to mention to you guys, Steven Spader at one point wrote a letter to one of the newspapers up in New Hampshire stating how stupid the general public of New Hampshire was and how everybody had gotten the story wrong and all this. Just a typical narcissist. And there's also another side story on this. This will leave you shaking your head, guys. The powers to be at Sauhegan High School in New Hampshire, where Glover and Marks attended, kept the profile of Quinn Glover and William Marks in their yearbook for that graduating class. Can you imagine that? This hit the newspaper in New Hampshire like you wouldn't believe. It went like wildfire. These two murderers are in your kid's yearbook. There's a profile sitting right there. I don't know what they say in their profiles. I like long walks on the beach and hitting girls with machetes. Man, so the powers that be, the school board, had to really explain themselves. They end up apologizing. But once that thing goes to print, it's over. They had elected to keep it in there. They're trying to out-liberal their common sense. That's what happened there. And what an offense to the Cates family to do that. How insensitive, how absolutely insensitive. And that was a portion of the letter that Steven Spader had written to the newspaper saying that they should be able to be in their yearbook and all this. It's just insane. So many levels of insanity and sadness in this case. Man, it's just a head shaker, really. So after the first episode, guys, I was wondering how much money did they get from the house? What did they get in terms of jewelry? You know what they took? They took like two old wooden jewelry boxes with Kimberly's trinkets in it and all that. And it was ended up being worth about $130. All of this was done for $130. And they threw half of it away in the Nashua River. Man, just so senseless. So in the aftermath of all of this, you're probably wondering how the remaining members of the Cates family are faring. David Cates and Jamie still live in New Hampshire. I believe they still live in Mount Vernon. And they're very active in the community. And Jamie did have some significant injuries. She's recovered from them. I believe chief among them was a foot injury that was really bad, that one of those guys hit her with a machete. It's hard to say. One of those guys hit her in the foot and kind of split her foot with a machete. She's absolutely lucky to be alive. But in the aftermath, they went on to do a lot of good work. They started a golf tournament and charity that to date has distributed over $250,000 in scholarships in Kimberly Cates' name. And again, they still live in Mount Vernon, and now they have a dog by the name of Dutch. He's a German Shepherd. Things go pretty well for those two now. They've seemed to heal pretty well, or as much as you possibly can. And Jamie Cates went to court only once during these trials, and that was to see Christopher Gribble led away for the rest of his miserable goddamn life in handcuffs. And if you want to talk about bravery, if you want to look up bravery in the dictionary, Jamie Cates' photograph should be right there. That's one brave kid. She did not let this destroy her. Just she didn't. They refused. So I had also mentioned earlier in this podcast, guys, that the New Hampshire legislature had filed a new law, a new bill. I believe it did come into law that home invasion homicide was added to the list of capital offenses. And that was under the governor. But in 2019, that was overridden by a Democrat majority, I guess, in the House, and that is no longer in effect. So I don't know what these soft on crime people are thinking. I simply don't. You're sleeping in your bed and somebody comes in with a machete and you don't think they deserve capital punishment? I got two words for you and I'm not going to say them right here. Also, I had mentioned in the yearbook issue that they were trying to out-liberal their common sense. I think that's what's happening in the criminal justice system now. And what are you going to do with Christopher Gribble, right? There's a certain segment of the political body who wants to get rid of prisons. Where does Christopher Gribble go? When you ask them those specific questions, they don't know. They don't care. They're trying to out-liberal their common sense. Put evil people in prison. It's pretty simple, guys. All right, guys, so next week we're going to be covering a case from Vermont. I had asked you all to provide me some cases from the state of Vermont, and one kept coming up over and over again, and we'll be covering that case next week. So tune in for that one. I'm going to leave you right there. I'll see you on the flip side.